Okay, so this is a meeting organised by the Socialist Party. The subject of today's meeting is Anthropology and the Human Subject, which is written by Brian Morris, who is here. I don't think he's going to go through the whole of this book. He's just going to speak for 45 minutes. Brian isn't actually a member of the Socialist Party, but he's a long-standing friend of the party who's spoken at our meetings and things before. I think you said you're going to speak for about, let's say, 45 minutes. So,
yeah, do you mind if I stand up? I always feel a bit freer when I stand up, a thing like that. I'm going to talk about the human subject. I'll explain first how I got interested in it, actually. You know, I'm a kind of academic failure. I failed my 11 plus, and I left school at 15, and I tried to get into university when I came back from Africa when I was 30 years of age and couldn't get in because I didn't have any A levels, you know. So I went. I trained as a student teacher, and in my final year, I did a course with the chap there who was one of the tutors who was a sociology tutor. And he taught a course called the Education of Persons. He taught this course, and it was all on the subject. You know, what is a human being, and you know, how do we treat human beings, and all that. And the whole focus is on humans. You know, and that's when I first got interested in it. It's through him, things like that. Years later, I got a part-time job at Goldsmith and teaching anthropology to psychology students, and eventually we got a joint degree going between psychology and anthropology. And in those days, and I don't think anything's changed, psychology was basically a study of individuals, and it was all about rats and it was about cognition, you know. And so the poor old students, they were going to anthropology and learning all about culture and society and all that sort of stuff, and they were all getting rats and cognition from the psychologists, don't they? And we thought that what we needed was a course actually that brought the two disciplines together, that united psychology with an interest on the human being, with anthropology interested in social life and culture. Okay, and the course I taught then, this is 30, 40 years ago, the talk I was then was called Psychological Perspectives in Anthropology, and these are my lecture notes actually. You know, over the years I've taught this sort of thing. Time flies as well, because a couple of years ago I gave a talk on Karl Marx, actually, and I tried to sort of suggest that Karl Marx was a kind of an anthropologist, really, that kind of, and it was actually put into the social thing, which was very nice, things like that. I'm going to leave Karl Marx to the end, okay? Hope you don't mind. I don't want to repeat myself or things like that. So what I'll do, I'll talk a bit about anthropology, and then I'll talk about the three ways I think people tend to look at the individual. The one way of looking at them is a kind of essentialist way. This, an individual is like this, sort of Homo sapiens or whatever. Okay, look at it in sort of 1, 2, 3. Look at it just as an essence. And then to look at the human being in a kind of dualism, you know, a kind of polarity of twosome. And then eventually I want to show that, you know, and I'll go on to talk, hello, coming to Marx, that actually to look at the human being in a kind of a triadic way, look at it in three ways to look at the human person, okay? So that's what I'll basically do. I start off talking about anthropologists. I always have a plug for socialism and anthropology. I'm always sort of defending those two. A few years ago, I've probably shown you this before, a few years ago, there was this great thing, the Great Divide, and it was all about anthropology. Anthropology is the study of people. That's what it means in Greek. Anthro is people, logos is the study of. So anthropology just means the study of people. A few years ago, there was this great divide because it was felt that anthropology, poor old anthropology, was getting torn apart. It was getting torn apart by the kind of anthropologists that were very kind of, sort of, they had an affinity for all the social biologists. Okay, so they were moving towards biology. And then there was all the, I don't know if it means anything to you, but there was all these people that were referred to as postmodernists. They're postmodernists, okay? Who weren't interested in science and weren't interested in biology, and they wanted. So poor old anthropology was either the sociobiology people were trying to make anthropology into a branch of biology, or the postmodernists who were trying to pull anthropology to be a study of literature or poetry or things like that. You know, to make it a literary thing, okay? Some people like me, and not every anthropologist, tried to hang on to the things and realised there's a kind of dual heritage in anthropology. Anthropology's got, it's like riding on two horses. On the one hand, anthropologists are always interested in humans, human beings. Where do they come from? The evolution of humans. You know, what humans have in common throughout the world. They've always been interested in that. On the other hand, anthropologists are always interested in diversity. They realise that, you know, people in the jungle of Malaya are quite different from people living down in Bermondsey. You know, that there's a diversity in human cultures, and humans are not just animals, they're actually kind of social beings and they live in cultures. So anthropology is also the study of culture, you know. And what's happened historically, all the good anthropologists have tried to hang on to these two things. In other words, they're interested in people in a universal sense, what people have in common, and they're also interested in what people, all their differences and what they don't share, and all their different cultures. So there's always been a kind of, and I'll come back to this sort of dichotomy later, because I think what you've got to understand about human beings, they are torn, in a sense. So there's, we're both biological and we're cultural, so we're both things like that. So that's so much about anthropology. But it comes back because that tension is held together also by Marx, for instance. He's also aware of this tension that there is, and he's trying to hold on to both sides, you know, not forgetting we're biological beings, but also not forgetting we're social beings at the same time. Right, starting off, some people look at the human being, you know. What I'm going to say is, what is a human being? I mean, you all know what a human being is. But I'm going to ask the question, what is a human being? Okay. Now, some people look at the human being from one way. They say, well, human being, and you know, there's all these homos, okay? Homo sapiens, which is Linnaeus. You know, we're mindful. You know, we've got a mind, as it were. No. Homo phobia, you know? We're toolmaker with things, homo ludens, you know, we're playful things. And there's lots of these, the books are full of them. You know, I just was reading a book today and there's another, I forgot what it is now, but another homo whatnot. You know, they're sort of looking at an individual, the human being, in one way. You look at him as, you know, the playful human, the mindful human, the economic human, all that, looking at things in one way. Now, it is quite interesting, in many ways, that there's a kind of, when they look at the person as an individual in one way, there's two extremes which go to. There are some people who say, oh, for goodness sake, there's no such thing as human nature. You know, forget it. Forget it. There's no such thing as human nature at all. Human beings, there's a book by the evolutionary psychologist called Steve Pinker, you know, and he's written a whole book called The Blank Slate. And he more or less, you know, it's a criticism of anthropologists, really. You know, the whole book, you know, slagging off anthropology, really. Saying these anthropologists are useless, you know, because they think that humans are a blank slate. Because they put the emphasis on culture, you know, and they ignore biology. It's looking at people as a blank slate. Okay? That's the one extreme. Most anthropologists don't look at humans as a blank slate. But that's what this argument, that there is no human nature. Marx didn't think that, but that's what some people argue. You know, all these postmodernists, some of these cultural anthropologists, there's no such thing as human nature. At the other extreme, you've got people saying, oh yes there is, a human nature, and I'll tell you exactly what it's like. Okay, and they've got these books that have come out, and there's people like, there's an evolutionary psychologist, one, okay? They say we lived as hunter-gatherers, actually, you know, years ago, and it's actually, what we are is built into our kind of genes. In our genes, just exactly what they are. What are people like? Well, people by nature, some of these people argue, people, you know, by nature, what are we? We're aggressive, you know, humans are aggressive creatures. I mean, they're just like that. That's part of their nature, built into their genes. Okay, they're aggressive, they're very greedy, they're all out for maximising things. I mean, that's to be a human being, is to kind of be concerned with making a profit and egoism. You know, that there's that very strong sort of emphasis that this is what we like. And it's still around, particularly the evolutionary biologists. And I know some people don't read books, but there's a really interesting book here, which you lot published many, many years ago, you know, saying basically it's not in our genes, okay? It's arguing against that. Some people go to even more extremes, and they actually not only say that we've kind of got a nature, which is, you know, it all comes from Hobbes. I don't know if you know this philosopher Hobbes. you know, way back in the 16th century, very famous politician, you know. He was against the divine right of kings, but actually he still wanted the king. Because he said in the state of nature, people are nasty, life is nasty, shortish and brute, or whatever, nasty, brutish and short kind of thing. Basically, we're nasty people by nature. People are nature. Therefore, you want a strong government to stop people tearing each other. And he talked about a war against all, you know, a war against all. You know, we're all sort of egoists, and it's all aggression, territory, competition, greed, all that sort of stuff. Okay, it's gone against that. That's the kind of image. And some people have gone even further extreme. They're even further extreme. And they not only say we've got this nature, which is not very nice, but they actually argue that really, that human beings are really nasty. It's a sort of, you know, it's going back to the Christian ethic of original sin, that somehow or other, human beings by nature, their very nature, they're nasty, okay? I mean, Nietzsche, there's a famous quote by Nietzsche. It was a very interesting character, Nietzsche, because he writes in so many different ways. You can come at him from any angle. But one sort of famous saying of Nietzsche, he said, the earth is beautiful except for one thing, human beings, and there are pox on earth, you know? And years ago, I was very, very involved with sort of people who call themselves deep ecologists. There was this idea, you know, that, you know, there was an ecology, you know, there was an ecology crisis, there was deforestation, you know, global warming, pollution and whatnot. So we had to change our attitude and things like that. And some of these deep ecologists were basically arguing things like in the Sudan in the 1980s, when there was people were dying of starvation, were saying, oh, let nature take its course. You know, let nature take its course. And there's one famous article by Christopher Maines, who's a very famous American ecologist and whatnot. He said, AIDS, it's the best thing that's ever happened to humans. You know, best thing that's ever happened. It'll get rid of it, because there's too many people anyway. You know, get rid of these people, you know, and then all, you know, Africa can go back to having a nice sort of animals with sort of elephants and things all over the place, kind of thing, you know. So with that emphasis on the kind of individual, the emphasis on the single kind of way of looking at it, that humans have an essence, okay? They go to this kind of extreme, and we're, you know, everything is determined by our genes, or completely extreme, we're nasty creatures by nature anyway, nothing can do about it. Of course, that sort of thing, you need salvation by religion, you know, just like in the original sin. If people are nasty by nature, you know, the only way of resolving things, actually, well, you need God, you need redemption, and you need God to save us. Okay. But, of course, many people have argued, oh, for goodness sake, what you've got to realise, you can't just look at humans in one way and say, this is what they're like. You know, homo, whatever, you know, that or that. Actually, you've got to recognise that humans basically are biological and they're social. You know what I'm saying? And this, you know, when dear old, I've always had a fun time, what do you call it? I've always had a fondness, actually, for old Aristotle, mainly because he's a biologist. I don't really agree with his politics, mind you, but, you know, Aristotle. And Aristotle defined humans basically as animals, and animals with reason. That was his ideas. Or he talked about them as a political. So they were animals with the social things. So Aristotle recognised that human beings were not only animals, but they were also intrinsically social beings, okay? So there's this idea of a kind of, to look at humans really, not to see them in one way, but to see them in two ways. There was a kind of duality. We were kind of biological, and we're kind of social and cultural, and we things like that. And there's a famous quote, which I'll give you, and mainly, of course, it was quoted at me when I was a student, because I did sociology as of my main course. And one of the gurus of sociology when I studied it was a chap called Emil Durkheim, who was an educationalist and a sociology living in France at the end of the 19th century. Okay, and this is a quote from old Emil Durkheim. Man, of course, I use the word man in those days, you know. They actually meant humans, but they talk about man. Man is double. There are two beings in him. An individual, that which has its foundations in the organism, and the social being, which represents the highest reality and intellect and moral by which we know by observation. Okay? So somebody like somebody like dear old Durkheim basically argued in a kind of dualistic fashion. We're actually both sort of biological beings, okay, and we're social beings. Now, what's always fascinated me when I've reading all these books over the years, as it were, there's a lot of different people that come from very different intellectual traditions. And they all got it in their mind that when you're looking at humans, there's a paradox. There's a kind of paradox, a contradiction. And the paradox is this, and you get it, there's people like Bruce Trigger, who's an archaeologist and is a Marxist, there's people like Eric Fromm, you know, there's people like Husserl, there's people like, you know, Mumford, you know, Lewis Mumford, very, very different people. But they all argue, look, what you've got to realise, there's a paradox. When we're talking about human existence, there's a kind of paradox there. And the paradox is this, that at one level, okay, we're intrinsically a part of nature. And at another level, because we're very complex socially, we've got culture, we've got symbolic thought, we've got a sense of self-consciousness, okay? We've got these intricate tools that we've developed, you know, vast number of kind of technology and all that, that actually we're quite distinct from nature. And often we see ourselves as distinct from nature, okay? So on the one hand, we're intrinsically a part of nature, and on the other hand, we see ourselves, you know, given our language and our technology and our symbolic way of thinking of things, that we're kind of separate. And there's a paradox there, and that's what the stress. And there's a famous painting in the Vatican, and it shows you Plato and Aristotle. It's a very famous painting by Raphael, and they're walking along, and there's the old man who's Plato, of course, and Plato was very religious, you know, he was a very, very, you know, very religious character. He's almost a shaman, actually, you know. And it's got him pointing up like that. He's the older man with grey hair, a bit like me. And he's pointing to the heavens, you know, culture, the spirit, God. Okay, and there's Aristotle going like that, which is pointing to the ground. Okay, and that sort of stresses the paradox. You know, half of us is all in the imagination, and the other half of it is very empirical and rooted in the earth sort of thing. And we've got that. And one of the early Roman philosophers called Cicero. Cicero said, we have two natures. We have one nature, which is our first nature, which is biological, and we have a second nature, you know? We have a second kind of nature, which is our kind of social and things like that. Now, the other thing that's linked with this idea that we're dual, or there's a paradox, or there's a duality in human life, is the fact, like a lot of other animals, that human beings, their brains are split down the middle. We actually got two hemispheres, which are quite separate. And there's a lot of studies been doing this over the years by psychologists, particularly now by new, you know, we've got all these new neuroscientists looking in at the brain sort of thing, you know, so the thing like that. And what they've discovered, that really these two sides of the brains have two kind of functions. And basically, and I'll read out to them, your left side of your brain, which is your right side of the body, which is dominant for a lot of people, okay, your left side of the brain is all to do with language, it's all to do with symbolism, it's all to do with analysis, splitting things apart, it's all to do with the right side of the body. Okay, it's all to do with focus, that you look on individual things. Okay, it's all to do with things in isolation, that you look at something in isolation. Okay, and you're basically interested in things that are not living. Okay, the other side, your right hemisphere, which is your left side of the body, is all into visual things, you know, making patterns. Okay, it's interested in thought that's not language. We actually think in. Some people think that language creates thought, but actually thought and language are quite separately, and we can think independently of language. Okay, we can think independent of language. So with the right hemisphere, there's this idea of a pre-linguistic thought. It's to do with synthesis, putting things together. It's to do with the left side of the body. It's to do not with things, but with relationships between things. Okay, it's putting things in context. And it's to do with living beings. Okay? That's it. And the typical example of this is when you look at a bird, a pigeon, feeding on the ground, a pigeon's got to do two things. He's got to make sure the old pigeon that is really focused on pecking that seed, recognizing the seed, seeing what the seed is, and eating it. And at the same time, he's got to be aware of the environment and things around him, okay? And looking at the things like that for dangers, you know, some sparrowhawk's going to come out of the sky or something like that. That is interesting in relations. And I don't know if you read Engels, some of you. If you read Engels, you know, the people tend to, not you, but and not people generally, but actually a lot of academics tend to, you know, dismiss old Engels. You know, he's an idiot, really. Marx is the great scholar. You know, Engels is sort of nobody. It's not true, actually. It's not true. Engels was extremely literate person, very knowledgeable. And like Marx, he had a kind of encyclopedic mind. And of course, well, he was suggesting donkeys years ago in the sort of 1870s, 1880s, that for goodness sake, and he called it dialectical thinking, we got to start not looking at things like with a sort of the left hemisphere, and just all we do, we look at things in isolation, but we've got to realise the importance of relationships and connections and totality. You know, that sort of thing. And realise that things are not static, everything's continually moving all the time. So what Engels was suggesting, and what everybody does all the time, of course, it's not that we're either right side or left side, or the right side is good and the left side is bad, or the right side is men and the left side is women. Actually, everybody everywhere uses both sides of the brain, just like the pigeons do. You know, we do is both sides of the brain. Of course, what Engels was saying, what is meant by dialectic is bringing these two things together, being aware of something as an individual thing, but to realise at the same time that you have to look at the relationships between them, that sort of thing. Okay, so that's looking at things in terms of a duality. But even that's limited. Okay, even that's limited, because when you look at human beings, they're not only human beings, you know, Homo sapiens or whatever. They're not only biological beings, and they're not only social beings. You know, they belong to a particular culture, you know, they do certain things. You know, they're not only that. There's a third aspect to them, actually. And the fact is, they're kind of unique. And this is the importance of somebody like Darwin, and why Marx was very, very keen on Darwin. You know, when Darwin's book, The Origins of Species, was published, you know, Marx was really absolutely, he was critical of certain aspects of it, but he was, you know, all this emphasis on competition and Malthusian stuff and whatnot. But basically, he really liked Darwin. He really liked Darwin. The two things that were important about Darwin, of course, Darwin emphasized things change and evolve, and you can only understand things in terms of time. He also emphasised what was important, actually, to recognise that everything in the world, not just human beings, but animals, plants, things, are individuals. They're kind of unique. Everything's unique. Everything's unique. Everything, nothing else is like it, you know? So it's not just, you're not just a human being. You're not just a member of a club or a member of a particular society. You're also unique. You're a kind of a unique being in itself. And so there was this notion that instead of a duality, there's a kind of triad. And actually, it goes back to Kant, and I mentioned Kant when I was talking about Marx before. Kant's looked upon as one of the great philosophers, you know. You have to remember, he wasn't just a philosopher. He only did philosophy in his old age, you know. He actually was, most of his life, he was a teacher, and most of his life he was interested in physical geography. He was interested in the earth and how the earth moves and all that sort of stuff, you know. And he was also interested in anthropology. In fact, he wrote a book called Anthropology from a Pragmatic Point of View. And he wrote that when he was 74 years of age. And he'd been teaching anthropology for about 20 years. So it's really quite false. When you read about Kant, you think of Kant as just being a philosopher. He was much more than just a philosopher. And that book, which was called Anthropology from a Pragmatic Point of View, what he meant by pragmatic was actually to use knowledge to make the world a better place for us, which was the Enlightenment idea. You know, you use knowledge to make the world better, you know, to give us more freedom, to give us more dignity, you know, that kind of thing. That's what he meant by pragmatic. Not useful in a narrow sense, but kind of much wider. And what he did in that book, he said, really, looking at human beings, you've got to realise there's three things to look at when you look at human beings. Three things to look at. One is that they're men. Mensch, which actually, I think in German, means people. Not men. There's a lot of missed things. Very often when people translate from other cultures, what in other cultures means humans, when it gets translated into English, it's translated as men. You know, and I'm not sure you may know, but I think very often when Marx uses the word Mensch, I think, which in German means humans, but when it's translated into men as opposed to women. You know, so that thing. So he argued that he used the word Mensch, which is that people are actually humans. People are also self. They have selves. They have their own individuality. They have their own uniqueness about them. And he also talked about people as social beings. So instead of being a triad or just a paradox, there's a triad. Not just a duplex, a two-ish. There's a threesome. That we're biological beings. We're actually, you know, humans. We're actually unique beings. You know, we have our own uniqueness. And we're basically social beings. We have our roles. We belong to different cultures and all that sort of things. So there's a kind of... It's a kind of a threesome. That was Kant. And it reminded me, when I was a student at college... at the LSE. When I was doing the LSE, one of the books I had to read was by a chap called Clyde Cluckholm, who was an anthropologist, and he'd done lots of studies on Navajo witchcraft, people of the Navajo in New Mexico, you know. And he was described as a Navajo. He was so into the culture, and he spoke the language so well that the Europeans there used to refer to him as a Navajo, you know, because he was things. And he was a very good anthropologist and lived most of his time amongst the Navajo. And he wrote a book about 1940, which in its day was quite well known, but now nobody reads it, and it's all remainder, of course. And it was called The Mirror of Man. And basically, The Mirror of Man was to say that when you do anthropology, because you're looking at another culture, you reflect back on yourself. By definition, anthropology is reflexive, because if you study these people here, wherever it is, you know, you're making a comparison with yourself and your own culture, so it's kind of reflexive. And what always I remembered about Cluckholm, he had this very simple distinction, which I think is quite important, although it's quite basic and simple. He said, human beings, there are some ways. In which a human being is like every other human being. There are some ways that we have share and we do things the same as every other human being. There are some ways that people, things that they do and what they say and how they do it, it's like some people and it's not like others. Okay? So there's ways the Navajo act. The only people who act that way are the Navajo. You know? They think like that. And the third thing about us is that there's some things we share with everybody. There's some things we share only with a few people, and there's other things that are unique to us as individuals. And it's the same kind of a triad. Okay. Now, I'm just going to finish, because I've got to Marx, because I didn't want to repeat myself what I said before a couple of years ago. But when you read Marx, Marx is an interesting character, really, because he has the same triadic things. He doesn't have a simple way. He realised that humans are complex characters, you know. Human beings are complex, you know. And so he doesn't have a kind of, you know, a simple way of looking at them. He realised that there's these three ways kind of you can kind of look at them. First of all, he recognised that human beings are natural beings. You know, it's quite obvious. He realised that people have a nature as such, okay. He realised that. It wasn't that... People, for Marx, people weren't blank slates. He realized they had a certain nature and they had certain needs. And I'll give you a quote from his early writings. But this is even obvious in his later thing. This is a bit from Marx. Okay. Humans, you know, man is directly a natural being. As a natural being and as a living natural being, he is, on the one hand, equipped with natural powers. He is an active natural being. These powers exist in him as dispositions or capacities. On the other hand, as a natural, corporal, sensuous, objective being, he is a suffering, conditioned and limited being, just like animals and plants, you know. So it's quite clear for Marx that humans are natural beings. That humans are natural. They have a nature. They have certain needs that are basic. What's also interesting about him, you know, just to sidetrack a bit, you know, when people, the Marxist tradition that's developed from Marx and Engels, okay, it's often seen that there's kind of two strands. In fact, what you've got to realise, and it's quite explicit in Marx and Engels, quite in both of things like that, what they wanted to do when they were, you know, when they were youngsters and learning things in Germany and whatnot, what they realised, what they wanted to do was, they were really fascinated with Hegel. And what for them was important of Hegel was not all his religious stuff and not all to do with Geist and, you know, humans going through things. Two things they thought was important about Hegel. One, he was a historical thinker. He stressed that everything was changing all the time. Two, he was a dialectical thinker. So what they wanted to retain from Hegel was his dialectics, way of thinking, not thinking in terms of dualisms, and they wanted to retain his kind of historical way of thinking. They were also fascinated by another German scholar and philosopher called, basically forgotten about him now, called Ludwig Feuerbach, who was a materialist. You know, in an earthly, you know, the emphasis that we're earthly beings, okay? And just like with Hegel, there's some things they liked about Feuerbach and there's some things they didn't like about Feuerbach, okay? What they liked about Feuerbach, that he was a materialist. You know, he was a materialist. Of course, you probably realise this. Marx's PhD thesis, you know, when he was a young lad, you know, only 21, 22, 23, his PhD thesis was on the Greeks. And it was on the Greeks, Democritus and Epicurus, who were actually the two philosophers in ancient Greece who were materialists. And he was particularly fascinated with Epicurus. Because what Epicurus, although Epicurus was a determinist and a materialist, also what he appreciated with Epicurus, just like what he appreciated with Darwin, the importance of contingency, okay, and the importance of freedom, which is the individual in freedom. And that's what he liked about Epicurus, was that Epicurus was stressing the importance of freedom, human freedom. So there's these two strands, you know, that are coming from Marx and Engels, okay? Which is the reason why I think the term dialectical materialism more or less portrays what their way of looking at things is. It's a dialectical materialist or a historical materialist. Because dialectical materialism has gone out of fashion because it's all associated with old Stalin, you know? So people don't like it. But it actually depicts what they are. On the one hand, the emphasis on dialectics and history. On the other hand, their emphasis on materialism. And they're putting the two together. And what's happening since then, of course, just like in anthropology, where some people are pulling towards biology and some people are pulling towards culture, you've got that strand in Marxism, in a way. There are some people very, very keen on dialectics and Hegel and whatnot, and are anti-materialists, and there's some people like Althusser are all into science and materialism and forget history, you know? So there's that kind of tension. What Marx didn't like about Feuerbach, they agreed with his materialism. What they didn't like about Feuerbach, what Marx said, he was contemplative. He just thought, you know, there is a material world, it exists, and we're material beings, okay. What he forgot to bring in is one that we interact with the world, and the other, there's history. There's history to take into account, you know? So it was. They were very critical of Feuerbach. They're very critical of Feuerbach, and the reason was because Marx put an essential emphasis not only that we are natural beings, but by definition we had to live. We weren't just alive. We had to produce the fact that we were alive, and we produced that through labour. And I'll give you another nice quote, which is out of Capital. And it stresses what is important for Marx, actually, is the interrelationship between humans and the natural world. And it's intrinsic. It's intrinsic. We can't exist without that interaction. And this is how he defines labour. Labour is, first of all, a protest between humans and nature, a process with which man, through his own actions, mediates, regulates and controls the metabolism between himself and nature. Labour is the universe condition for the metabolic interaction between humans and nature, the everlasting nature-imposed condition of human existence. In other words, nature imposes on us the fact that we have to interact with nature in order to keep alive, that kind of thing. So what I think is important about Marx, you know, like Kant in a way, he recognised that there was, to look at humans, you had to realise that humans were biological beings, natural beings. They had to produce their own life. They not only had to produce culture, they had to produce the fact that they were alive, had to produce life. They were basically social beings. In fact, another one of his criticisms was with Feuerbach. Feuerbach had the idea of human beings, and you know, he stressed the importance of humans. Instead of like Hegel expressing the interest in Geist, you know, a universal soul or whatever, you know, Feuerbach stressed the importance of the individual. But Marx said the trouble was that Feuerbach had this idea of a kind of abstract individual. He didn't recognise that individuals are social beings. And there's that famous, you know, in the one of his quotes is, you know, human beings are not just individuals, they're ensembles of social relationships. In other words, they're basically social beings, okay? So Marx was stressing that we're individuals, that we're biological, we have certain needs, we have to interact with nature. At the same time, we're social beings. We interact with our livelihood is based on the fact we're social. But the third thing, of course, was the fact that we're in unique individuals. And because Marx always put an emphasis on the fact that of freedom. Not a kind of metaphysical freedom that we're kind of free by nature, but actually a kind of social freedom, that we could only really be free in a social... And that's why he was against all the anarchists like Stirner, who said, I'm free. I'm free. You know, and he's like, because you're very well not free. You can only be free in a society which actually, you know, what for Marx would be a communist or a socialist society where you can have social freedom. You weren't kind of metaphysically free. He was thinking free. But it was important for their freedom. And finally, it's interesting when you look at what comes out the Enlightenment, because I think what you've got to... most academics and most anthropologists nowadays slag off the Enlightenment. You know, they're always slagging off the Enlightenment. They blame the Enlightenment for everything. But actually, both Marx and anthropology come out of the Enlightenment. Both of them come out of the Enlightenment. And what is important about the Enlightenment, particularly if you look at the rallying cry of the French Revolution, was equality. In other words, people are all the same everywhere. People are all human beings. Equality, fraternity, social solidarity. They're social beings. Okay, and the last one is liberté, you know, the importance of human freedom. And that, well, I think that Marx always had that triadic, and he always supported those three sort of, you know, the fact we were natural beings, the fact we were social beings, and the fact we were kind of unique individual beings, and the importance of human freedom. That's it, 45 minutes.
Okay, thanks, Brian.